Okay, good afternoon. This is BIO-241. It's October 8th, and you just took a test last period, and I've graded two lab sections. One Tuesday night, they saw theirs, and then Wednesday's lab section, and I don't know if you saw yours in lab today or not. You saw at least your grade, but the instructor from the night session didn't give me the answer keys back, so I couldn't give you the answer keys because I was in class, so I didn't have time to photocopy another version of the answer key. So I guess next Wednesday you can actually take a look at the test, make sure your Scantron was graded correctly. And you did give your Scantron back to the instructor, right? I hope so. Okay. So I don't have an impression how people did compared to the first test at all. Probably, I would guess most people did better. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to put it on Blackboard as soon as I have them all graded. And so the first time you can actually see it is Monday, but it will probably be available maybe by Friday on Blackboard to know what your grade is. Okay. I would say come up to my office during office hours, but I might not get them graded, not all the lab sections, until I go home Thursday night. So you won't be able to see me Thursday during the day for that. Okay. Okay, so I guess that's all I got to say about that. So the Friday lab section, you should see the key and your Scantrons on Friday as well. Okay? Okay, so we're in the middle of electrophysiology, and that is chapter 7. We just got done talking about an action potential. And don't forget, what's another name for potential? It just means voltage. That's right. Means the separation of charge. And that's across the membrane. And action potential means what in terms of voltage in the cell? Action means what? Something's changing. The voltage is changing, right? And when we looked at resting membrane potential, remember we said resting membrane potential is due to a concentration difference across the membrane of ions, but also, and probably more importantly, is the permeability of the membrane to specific ions. So don't forget, if sodium is allowed to enter the cell, what's going to happen to the resting membrane potential? Is it going to stay the same or change? It's going to change, right? So when you change the permeability of the membrane to an ion so it can move through the membrane, the voltage of that membrane is going to change, or the potential of that membrane is going to change. Okay. And in particular, if a positive charge moves into the cell will become more positive. What do we call that process when the inside of a cell becomes more positive? Depolarization. And when the inside of the cell becomes more negative, you call that repolarization, or you could call it hyperpolarization if it's below the resting membrane potential. Okay. So that's what you have to know about an action potential. Make sure you can draw this out. Maybe your lab instructor might actually have you draw it out as a quiz and label it and say something about it. But you should know that there are at least two important phases of an action potential. What's the first one? What happens first? Depolarization. Yeah, let's start with a nice, very basic concept. Depolarization. What is causing depolarization? Yeah, the stimulus is causing depolarization. But once depolarization starts, what is happening through the membrane? What's the voltage-gated channels are opening, and something's moving through. What's moving through? Sodium. Yeah, and which way is sodium moving? Yeah, it's going from outside to inside. All right, what's the second phase of an action potential? Yeah, repolarization. All right, so the first phase is depolarization, second phase is repolarization. So I'm just actually kind of reiterating some points I would make in like a Bio-160 class when they first start to learn about an action potential. All right, so an action potential in its most basic form has got two phases. First one is depolarization, second is repolarization. Depolarization is due to sodium entering the cell. Repolarization is potassium leaving the cell. And that gets back to the resting membrane potential. Okay, but in this class, you got to know a little bit more than that. right? You have to know something about what the resting membrane potential is in a typical cell. It's about minus 70 millivolts, right? You got to know something about a stimulus right here. We're going to look at a couple different kinds of stimuli today. And if this stimulus causes a depolarization, that's what we call excitatory. If there's an excitatory stimulus, it takes the resting membrane potential towards the threshold. And when it reaches threshold, that's when the action potential starts. All right, so the first event for an action potential, as somebody stated nice and clear in here, was what? Stimulus. There's got to be a stimulus. And if there's a proper stimulus, meaning if it reaches threshold, then depolarization takes place. Sodium rushes in. What happens right here at this point in the action potential? Something happens. Okay, the potassium starts to enter, but what about, it was in the other chapter. What happens at this point right here? Oh no, here it is, right here. Relate this figure to an action potential. All right, so here's an action potential. I'm asking what happens right at this point in time that stops that sodium current. What stops the sodium current? This inactivation gate closes on the sodium channel. And so there's no possible way for the cell to depolarize any further because the sodium can't get through the membrane anymore. And it stops. All right, so right at the peak of the action potential, you would say that the sodium inactivation gate closes. And it stays closed until the action potential reaches RMP. And then that inactivation gate resets itself. It opens up. Even though the sodium channel is closed by now, the inactivation gate opens up. So during this period of time, right in here, the neuron cannot be stimulated into excitation again in producing an action potential, because that sodium inactivation gate is closed. So we call this the absolute refractory period. A refractory period is a period of time when the neuron cannot be stimulated into generating another action potential. All right, so you got the stimulus, you got threshold, you got the inactivation gate, all right, and then here is repolarization due to sodium channels. Potassium channels. And then here's something that you don't learn until you get to a class like this. All right, this area right here of hyperpolarization. So now the membrane is even charged up past the RMP. So we call this hyperpolarization. And this period of time is what we call the relative refractory period. Okay, so you might want to draw that in. I think we talked about all these slides already, so you should look at these things. All right, so depolarization and repolarization occur via diffusion, right? So you should think of the electrical gradient as well as the chemical gradient that are moving these ions around. Why does sodium want to enter the cell? Give me two reasons. Why does sodium want to enter a cell? What phase of an action potential does sodium enter? That's a good question on a test. Is depolarization, and we say it's just a passive process. Depolarization is a passive process. What is pushing or pulling sodium into the cell? Yeah, so two things. The electrical gradient and chemical gradient, because what's the charge on a sodium? It's positive. What's the charge inside the cell? And what do positive and negative charges like to do? They attract each other, right? So sodium gets pulled inside the cell. All right, what's another reason why sodium goes inside the cell? We just talked about the electrical gradient, which is the voltage. What else? The concentration gradient, because where is sodium at high concentration? Outside the cell, and when it has the ability to go inside the cell, of course it does go down its concentration gradient as well. So both of those factors draw sodium inside the cell, and it does not require ATP to do that. And the same thing for potassium. Why does potassium want to leave the cell? When does potassium start to leave? Right over here, right about here, okay, someplace in this region. What's the voltage inside the cell? It is Oh, I tell you what, right here at this point, let's read. What's the voltage inside the cell? It is positive, all right, which means the outside now is negative, right? So potassium is positive, and it's in the positively charged inside the cell. It's going to be drawn outside the cell because outside the cell is negative. So the electrical gradient reverses itself, so it draws potassium out. Why else does potassium want to leave the cell? Because it's low concentration outside, right? So potassium will just diffuse down its concentration gradient. So that is what this light is all about, right here. And then after the action potential moves out of that region, then the sodium-potassium ATP pump, right, reestablishes the proper gradients for sodium and potassium to produce a resting membrane potential. Okay, so what we have here are a couple different plots. Let's look at these graphs. We got two graphs. The top graph is a plot of membrane potential. This is a voltage versus time. And this looks like what? A nice action potential right here. Right? And what I don't see is the stimulus. But this just shows us the voltage that's caused by sodium diffusing into the cell during this part, this period of time right here. Right, so I think this area right here, which kind of looks blue to me, this is the period of time where the sodium channels are open. And then the inactivation gate closes. And this area right here, what color is that?
Green.
Wow, that's a really hard color to see. That's when the inactivation, the sodium inactivation gate closes. Maybe I can see it now. And the potassium channels are open, and that causes repolarization. All right, and then this is that area of hyperpolarization. So how can we relate different currents to what this action potential looks like? There are two different currents that are taking place. There's one current produced by a sodium ion, and there's another current that is produced by a potassium. Right, and so these currents are allowed because the membrane changes permeability. All right, so if we look at the bottom graph, we see the diffusion of sodium and potassium versus time, and it's justified to correspond to this action potential right here. Okay, so we said, what's the first channel, the fast channel? It's the sodium. Okay, so the sodium channel opens. Right, so this is just the sodium channel. It doesn't have anything to do with potassium. Right, so this is the diffusion of sodium. So the sodium diffuses very rapidly outside the cell, and then the diffusion of sodium stops so abruptly. Why does it stop so abruptly here? Because of the inactivation gate that closes. Okay, and what's the slower channel to open? That's the potassium channel. So it's activated right at the same time when something reaches threshold. It opens up, but it's slower to open up. It does not have an inactivation gate. And since it's slower, not only is it slower to open up, but it is also slower to close. So what's happening as potassium is leaving the cell? So this lower curve right here, what's happening to the membrane potential as potassium is leaving the cell? Is becoming more negative, right? So this just corresponds to the returning of that negativity inside the cell because of this potassium channel. And slowly it becomes inactivated because it's a slow kind of channel. But as the permeability of potassium still lingers on, even maybe 2 milliseconds after stimulation, that is still what? Hyperpolarizing the membrane. So anytime you see a current, that's going to cause a depolarization of when it's a current of sodium. Whenever you see a current of potassium, that's going to repolarize or hyperpolarize the membrane due to the different channels, either the sodium channel or the potassium channel. So it's good to be able to understand what's happening here in terms of changes in permeability to sodium, changes in permeability to potassium. Okay, so here we have a number of different action potentials, and When a membrane potential reaches threshold, an action potential is irreversibly fired. All right, where does this happen? Here we have a nice cell right here. What kind of cell does this look like? Yeah, neuron. Looks like a nice multipolar neuron right here. And so what part of the neuron is this? Soma. And what are these? Dendrites. And what part is this right here? Axon. And then we have some axon terminals right here, right? Sometimes they're called telodendria, right? We can just call these axon terminals. All right, and nerve impulses move across a neuron. That's what a neuron is specialized to do. Which way do nerve impulses go? Can they go from the axon terminals up to the dendrites, or the dendrites to the axon terminals, or both ways, or doesn't it matter? Can only go in one direction, right? So nerve impulse can only go in this direction, from dendrite or cell body down to the axon terminals. And we're going to see why that is in just a little bit. Okay. So one part of this neuron is the receiving part, and another part is the sending part. What part is the receiving part? The dendrites and even the cell body. So this area right here, I'm running out of board. This area right here, up right to about there. I got carried away. All right, right to about here. This is the receiving part. And from here, all the way down to here, is what part? That's the sending part. Okay, what's the membrane potential at rest of this cell? Minus 70 millivolts, no matter where you measure it on the axon or cell body, it really doesn't matter. Okay, and we learned about an action potential. Where does an action potential exist on the cell? Is it on the receiving part or the sending part, or are both? The action potential are only found on the sending parts. Okay, action potentials are only found over here. They're never found on the soma or dendrites. I don't think we talked about this yet. Now, what kind of membrane proteins allow for that action potential? Sodium and potassium something. Pumps. That will just reestablish a membrane potential. Okay. But there has to be something that changes the permeability in the membrane to sodium and potassium. What are the two parts of an action potential again, in the most basic form? You got what? You've got depolarization and repolarization. What's depolarization due to? Sodium-gated, what kind of channels? Yeah, sodium-gated voltage channels. So an action potential is due to, well, depolarization is due to what? Sodium? No. What a mess. Okay, the first thing is what? Yeah, sodium voltage gated sodium channels. I got to clean this up. All right, there's no sodium here. It's just due to what? Voltage-gated sodium channels. And what's the second part? Voltage-gated potassium channels. All right, so when a voltage-gated sodium channel opens, what happens? Sodium goes in. Yeah, but in terms of the membrane potential. It becomes less negative. What do we call it becoming less negative? That is depolarization. We'll do it again. Depolarization. All right. So, when voltage-gated potassium channel opens, what happens? I know potassium enters the cell, but in terms of the membrane potential, it does what? It repolarizes. Repolarization. Okay. All right, so let's just ask that question again, because this is strange for people just thinking about this kind of stuff. All right, what are the two parts of an action potential? In the most basic form, you got depolarization and repolarization. What's depolarization due to? Sodium entering the cell. Why does it enter the cell? Because there are voltage-gated sodium channels that let sodium in. They're fast, as a matter of fact, right? So we can say what? Fast for the sodium channels. The potassium channels are what? Slow. So that's the second part. Okay. And that's just dependent on the voltage of the membrane. So you have a whole bunch of voltage-gated sodium channels all the way around on this membrane. What part of the neuron is this right here? Kind of looks like a funnel. Axon hillock. So this is where you first start to have what kind of membrane proteins? This is where action potentials start. What kind of membrane protein do you need to have to start an action potential? You need a voltage-gated sodium channel. So this is where you have them right here. And as this depolarizes the membrane, what happens to this voltage-gated channel over here? Right, so as this protein is causing depolarization, this one is going up to threshold, right? And when it meets threshold, what happens to this one? It opens up and it starts what to happen in this part of the membrane, depolarization or repolarization? Depolarization. So when it depolarizes here, it's changing what? The membrane potential, making it go more positive. So then this one reaches threshold, right? As it's reached going up to the threshold voltage, so then it depolarizes, which causes this one here to reach threshold, which then does what? Depolarizes. And then this one, what happens here? This one reaches threshold and depolarizes. Well, can you get a feel for what's happening here? What's happening to that action potential? It's moving from left to right all the way down the axon. And the interesting thing about that motion is that if an action potential over here at the axon hillock, right, looks like that, what does an action potential look like way down over here at an axon terminus? It looks exactly the same. So if it doesn't change as it's moving down an axon, and this axon could be a million miles long. There aren't any, as far as I know, anywhere, but there could be an axon a million miles long. This action potential would be the same at the beginning compared to the end over here. So when an action potential moves, we say it moves without decrement down an axon, because each one of these different membrane proteins is going to propagate it to the next area of the axon. And then after depolarization moves, what's going to happen? What happens to this one after it depolarizes? It repolarizes, right? And then this one is going to repolarize. And this one is going to repolarize, right? So first you have a wave of depolarization, and then you have a wave of repolarization following each other. Okay, so we call this the sending part because it can send these action potentials without decrement very long distances. Okay, and it's the sending part because it has these voltage-gated channels in it that cause that action potential just to flow over this neuron. Okay, let me see what this slide says. So I'm going to try to leave that diagram on the board and use it later. Okay. All right, this slide right here just shows. So it's just a plot of membrane potential versus time at one particular place in the neuron. All right, so if we have, and these arrows right here just represent stimulus strength, the strength of a stimulus. And what could you tell me about the duration of these three different action potentials? Do they look the same or different? They look the same. What about the height of these action potentials? It's the same. Okay. So here we have four different kinds of stimulus. This first one right here is so weak that it does not cause an action potential. How would you draw that on a piece of paper? You'd have to draw what? Like voltage right here? Right? Stimulus voltage versus time. And where's it, what's a cell going to start out at? Like minus 70 millivolts. What do we call that? RMP, right? That's a resting membrane potential. I'm just going to say RMP. And if there's a stimulus, what's going to happen to this voltage that starts at RMP? It's going to go up to zero. It's going to become more positive. All right? And let's just say here is threshold. And if it doesn't reach threshold, what's going to happen? It's just going to die away and go back down to RMP. That's not an action potential, right? So on the slide up here, what have we drawn? We've drawn this. This is a stimulus because it causes depolarization, but it doesn't reach threshold, so it can't cause an action potential. So how would we talk about this stimulus right here? It is a sub-threshold stimulus. All right, so that's a sub-threshold stimulus, doesn't cause an action potential. And guess what? That won't travel down the axon. That won't excite this neuron into firing an action potential. All right, now let's say we come up with another stimulus that reaches threshold. What's going to happen? Action potential. All right, and we see that in the second case. And let's maybe come up with another stimulus, which is even greater. What's it going to produce? Right here, an action potential. And another one that's even greater. What's it going to produce? Action potential. But every action potential is going to be the same as long as the stimulus reaches threshold. It just has to reach the minimum level right here to create an action potential. Okay, so every action potential is exactly the same in amplitude and in duration. There's nothing different about action potentials. And what does this action potential sound like right here? If you were to listen to it, it would just be a blip. It would just be a blip and then go away. And this is how your brain communicates with itself, with other cells. If you were to listen to action potentials in the brain, it would just sound like, what, just a bunch of blips. And each blip would have the same kind of sound. All right, so we'll see how your brain actually understands a change of intensity. If every action potential is the same, how does your brain understand anything? Okay. So how is, we all know that, for instance, you're listening to my voice right now, and it kind of sounds like a voice because you've trained yourself to know what sound sounds like via development of your brain, and all of us in here, I think, have pretty more or less normal ears. All right, so if I talk softly, how does my voice sound? It sounds soft. And if I talk loud, my voice sounds loud. But what about action potentials reaching the brain? How are action potentials reaching the brain? Do they get louder and softer? They're always what? Exactly the same. So how is it that your brain can appreciate different stimuli even though the intensity of a stimulus is changing? Okay, and that's what this next slide shows us. It is done by what we call frequency coding. An increase in stimulus intensity causes more action potentials to be fired in a certain period of time. All right, so let's look at these action potentials with, so what kind of stimulus is this one right here? It's not causing any action potentials. What is that stimulus called? Sub-threshold stimulus. All right, and then let's turn on a threshold stimulus, but it's going to be a low intensity. Look at the difference in action potentials right here. What about the height? Is it going to be the same? Yeah, what about the duration? Hard to tell, but each one of these lines look the same. All right, so when we turn on this stimulus right here, what is your brain actually hear? It hears a blip, 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 blip at this particular intensity. All right, now, but let's increase the intensity. Can we see that there's an increase in intensity right here? Right, it's a little bit higher in amplitude. Now, how does your brain know that this is a stronger stimulus if each one of these action potentials is exactly the same? Well, in a certain period of time, so we're keeping the stimulus on for the same period of time right here, how many action potentials occurred with this threshold stimulus? Four. And if we increase the stimulus, now how many action potentials reach the brain in that same period of time? How many, you see what, 80 there or something? No, not quite that many. I can't count them. How many are there? 10? 12? I don't know. All right, so, and the amplitude, notice that the amplitude is the same. The only thing that changes is the repetition rate of action potentials, which is what we call frequency. All right, so if I was talking in a very soft voice, that auditory center in my brain is going to hear what? A blip, blip, blip. But if I'm talking very loud, what is your brain going to hear? Blip, 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 blip. Okay, it's just going to be a train of very fast blips, and your brain has the ability to translate that into making it seem like it's a louder sound. Or this could be light intensity. If it's a very dim light intensity, there's very few action potentials going to the brain, but if it's very bright light, what happens? The number of action potentials per unit time increases. So that's how your brain interprets stimulus intensity, by the number of action potentials for a certain period of time. And we call that frequency coding of intensity. Because an action potential is always the same. Now, why does that happen? Okay, it happens because of the refractory periods that are associated with an action potential. So who can tell me how many refractory periods does an action potential have? There are two. All right, there are two. What are the two? There is something called absolute refractory period and relative refractory period. During absolute refractory period, a neuron cannot transmit another action potential no matter what. No matter what level the signal, the stimulus intensity is, it just can't cause another action potential. But during the relative refractory period, right, if the stimulus is intense enough, it can overcome that blockage to creating an action potential. All right, so why is that? So here is the absolute refractory period. Right, from when depolarization starts until repolarization reaches RMP. And that's, so how would you, what is happening at least in this part of the action potential? Why can't we stimulate this neuron again? What, there's something that's closed. What's closed during this period of time? That inactivation gate, the sodium inactivation gate is closed. There's no way to initiate another action potential during this point in time. But right here, this is where that inactivation gate opens back up. And when it opens back up, then this nerve can be stimulated into propagating another action potential. All right, now what about at this point in time? This is what we call relative refractory period, because let's look at what the intensity of our initial stimulus was. What's our initial stimulus? It was, what's, 70 minus 55. What is that? How about 15? Okay. So the stimulus was 15 millivolts. Okay. So if we subtract 15 millivolts, it reaches threshold that starts an action potential. Let's keep that same stimulus intensity. Let's put a 15 millivolt stimulus right here. Now, what does this level look like right here? This looks like, you want to say like maybe 80? Minus 80 right here? Let's just say minus 80. Okay? So if this is minus 80 and our stimulus intensity is 15, what's it going to go to? It's going to go to 80 to 70 to 65. Will a stimulus that takes the membrane potential to 65 reach threshold? No. It is now a sub-threshold stimulus. Okay? It's a sub-threshold stimulus because it didn't reach threshold. But that 15 millivolt stimulus was exactly what? What the initial stimulus was that caused an action potential. So a threshold stimulus when the neuron is not in a refractory period will not cause an action potential when it is in a refractory period, because a 15 millivolt stimulus won't reach threshold. So therefore, what has to happen? This neuron has to wait way over to this period of time before it can be stimulated with that bare minimum threshold stimulus again. So that means that the action potentials are what? Spaced far apart from each other because of the relative refractory period. But if we have a strong enough stimulus, let's just say we have a 60 millivolt stimulus. So 60 millivolts will certainly stimulate it the first time. And 60 millivolts here will do what? It will go from 80 to all the way up to 20. Is that threshold? Yeah. Absolutely. And so that will initiate an action potential sooner because it's a strong stimulus. So if we go back to this slide right here, we see that these action potentials are spaced far apart because the relative refractory period is preventing another action potential from firing until the relative refractory period is over. But these action potentials can fire very rapidly in succession because this stimulus can overcome what? That relative refractory period. It can add to it and reach threshold. And your brain interprets that as a much higher intensity. Okay, axonal conduction. Let's talk about axonal conduction a little bit. Maybe I'll come back to that in just a little bit. Okay, so I kind of talked about this slide already by on the board, showing how an action potential is propagated. So when one area of an axon depolarizes, that might act as the stimulus for depolarizing another voltage-gated channel nearby, which can act as a stimulus for activating another sodium voltage-gated channel nearby, and that action potential is going to propagate down the axon without increment. That's just what I said. So the action potential amplitude is always the same. But in this particular neuron, how does this action potential flow over the membrane? It moves from one protein to another, to another, to another, to another, to another. And these proteins are all lined up with each other, right? From one molecule to another. So this kind of conduction is what we call continuous. Continuous conduction. But there's another way that cells can conduct electrical impulses via these action potentials. And in the peripheral nervous system, there are cells that can wrap themselves around an axon. And these cells are secreting myelin, which is a lipid. It's an insulator, electrical insulator. And since it's an electrical insulator, it won't allow any sodium currents to go across the membrane, wherever those cells are. Now, who can tell me the name of those cells? That's a Schwann cell in the peripheral nervous system. And in the central nervous system, those are called oligodendrocytes. All right, so I'm going to modify this axon a little bit. So I'm going to take away these voltage-gated channels right here, and I'm going to put a Schwann cell in this area with myelin. So in this area, can sodium enter or leave the axon? Can't, because of that insulation, the myelin sheath, right, in that area right there. And let me put another one here. And I'll get rid of these little channels, and I'll fill it in with myelin right over here. Okay. All right, so in this particular case, sodium can't go through the membrane. Plus, underneath the Schwann cell, there are no voltage-gated channels. There's no sodium voltage-gated channels. The voltage-gated channels you find only in between the Schwann cells. Okay? So what do we call this gap between the Schwann cells? I don't know if it's on the slide. That's a node of Ranvier. right? The node of Ranvier. Okay. So what happens in this case, right, is that when one node of Ranvier depolarizes, right, as sodium starts to enter the cell, that affects the opposite end of the Schwann cell. So this area over here is being stimulated. The voltage is increasing. Right? And when the voltage reaches threshold, what happens to this area right here? It depolarizes because those voltage-gated sodium channels open up. And as these voltage-gated sodium channels open up, there are none here that open, none here, none here, none here. But now these sense that voltage change way over here, which is a cell away. Right? So when these reach threshold, then this area depolarizes. So when you have a myelinated axon, the nerve impulse doesn't travel down an axon in a continuous fashion from one voltage-gated channel to the next, one molecule next to another molecule. It does what? It goes from one node to the next node. It actually hops down the axon. And so when that happens, the speed of conduction increases. So the speed of impulse conduction is a lot faster in a myelinated axon compared to a non-myelinated axon. And we don't call that continuous conduction. We call this saltatory. So saltatory conduction happens in a myelinated fiber, not a non-myelinated fiber. Okay, so saltatory conduction right here. And these are due to what? Voltage-gated sodium channels that are present only at these nodes. And of course, repolarization happens over here too because there's potassium voltage-gated channels as well that cause for repolarization. Okay, I'd want to go back now to one of the previous slides, cable properties. So we talked about in the axon, what kind of channels do we have for changing the permeability of the membrane to sodium and potassium? What kind of channels are those? They're voltage-gated channels, right? And we find them only on the axon. And if it's a myelinated axon, only at these nodes of Ranvier. All right, let's talk about the receiving end of this neuron right here. The receiving part does not have any voltage-gated channels, but how does this part of a neuron receive signals? Okay, these have what we call ligand-gated channels. Okay, a ligand-gated channel just means that we have a nice membrane right here that has some kind of protein in it. And in this particular case, is this channel open or closed? It looks closed, okay? All right, it's closed right here. Let me draw what it looks like when it's open. Okay, when this channel is open, it's going to look something like this. And so now what can happen? Sodium can enter the cell, and what happens to the cell when sodium enters? It depolarizes. Okay, so what gets this protein to change conformation? Over here, it was what? It was some change in voltage. But what's it over here for a ligand-gated channel? Okay, a ligand is just a molecule that's going to bind to some kind of receptor or maybe active site on an enzyme. All right, so let's just say that we have a signaling molecule that's a square thing right here. And this is its receptor. What can you tell me about some place on this receptor? What's something about the shape that you automatically know about this receptor? It's got to, right, there's got to be a complementary space on this receptor that can bind this ligand. So here we have a ligand, like this. So we have to have a spot on this receptor that looks like that so the ligand can bind to it. So this receptor has all of the characteristics of an enzyme, namely specificity. It has to have the right shape, saturation, right, and competition. If we have another molecule that looks like that, it can also, I didn't mean it to look like a mushroom, but that's very interesting. Okay. Okay. This molecule can also bind here, right? So it can compete for that site. And it might poison this particular protein because, for instance, when the normal ligand binds to this receptor, it's going to change its shape. It's going to open up, and then sodium is going to enter the cell. And what do we call that when sodium enters the cell? That's depolarization. But what also is it? It's also what? A stimulus, right? That when depolarization happens, that's a stimulus. And if the depolarization is sufficient enough to reach threshold, that can cause an action potential over here on the axon. So on this part of the neuron, we have ligand-gated channels that are not listening for voltage changes, it's listening for what? I'm speaking metaphorically. It's listening for signaling molecules, or what we call ligands. And when that signaling molecule binds to this receptor, right, it opens up a sodium channel, and then this part of the neuron depolarizes. So electrical signals then can flow from dendrites over the cell body and eventually find their way into the axon hillock. And if these ligand-gated channels open up for a sufficiently long period of time, or if there's a number of them that open up that cause this area here to reach threshold, then an action potential will start on the axon. Okay. So these electrical signals say if we have a depolarization, so what does a depolarization look like? We've got what? Voltage versus time right here. So this whole cell is at what? Minus 70 millivolts. So let's open up a sodium channel over here on this dendrite. And let's just say that in that area right there, it caused depolarization all the way to zero from, what is this? This is RMP. And then it dies away. But as this signal moves over the dendrite and through the cell body, guess what happens to it? It dies away. So this kind of potential, it's not a resting membrane potential, but it's not an action potential either. Because what can you tell me about an action potential? Never dies away. It's exactly the same. So this right here is what we call a graded potential. Action potentials are produced by voltage-gated channels. Graded potentials are produced by ligand. Where do I have it? Ligand-gated channels. And where do you have ligand-gated channels? Dendrites and cell body. Voltage-gated channels you have during the axon. So a good question I could ask you is, because axons have voltage-gated channels, what kind of potentials can occur on an axon? Action potentials, because they're voltage-gated channels. What kind of potentials do dendrites and cell bodies have? Graded potentials, and we call it graded potentials because what can you tell me about their amplitude? It's different, right? It's different on different parts of the axon. So they're graded, they die away. Furthermore, if we have a receptor here and a receptor here that cause a graded potential, they can what? They can meet and add together. So if each one is subthreshold, by the time they get to this axon hillock, it might be at threshold and will cause a stimulus. So they can sum together. So this part of the axon is very interesting because what is it doing? It's adding up. It's integrating signals from all the different dendrites and over the cell body, right? And it's making a decision. What kind of decision is it making? It's looking at all these different voltages, and it's ignoring all of them unless they do what? If they add up to reach threshold, then this part of every neuron makes a decision to do what? If it reaches threshold, fire an action potential. So every neuron in your body is making a decision for you because it's looking at graded potentials and deciding whether or not to send an action potential down this axon right here. And that's all due to the axon hillock right here, sometimes because It's making a decision on what to do. We not only call this the axon hillock, because this is where these voltage-gated channels start. Sometimes we call that the trigger zone. The trigger zone of a neuron, because it's making a decision on what to do. Okay, so what your book calls cable properties. I just called, what kind of potentials are these? Graded potential. So I think a better way of thinking about it is not really just in terms of cable properties, but in terms of two kinds of potentials. So what were the two kinds of potentials we looked at today? Action potentials, which go down an axon without decrement because of the voltage-gated channels, and graded potentials. And graded potentials start because of these ligand-gated channels, which may or may not reach threshold by the time they reach the trigger zone over here on an axon. All right, so if this axon, or if in this trigger zone, there are enough graded potentials to reach stimulus, you know, we put a little microphone over here, what is it going to sound like? Bloop. Okay, that's how your whole brain realizes reality in terms of blips. It's very kind of interesting. How is it that it can do all that? Okay, so don't forget, these graded potentials leak out. So graded potentials leak out of dendrites in the cell body, and it may or may not reach threshold by the time it reaches the trigger zone. Okay. All right, synaptic transmission. Oh, I really hate to erase this. But I have to. Where should I erase? Over here someplace. Okay, so I think there's an interesting note on the board right here, because is there SI today? Is there usually SI today? There usually is no SI today? Oh, okay. Well, in any case, there's SI tomorrow, right? So don't go to SI today. I thought it was today for some reason. Usually. But it's not today, but it is tomorrow. So hopefully you might be able to talk about some of these things. All right, so now I think you got a pretty good feeling for why one part of the neuron is the receiving part and another part is the sending part. What kind of channels does the receiving part have? Ligand-gated channels. What kind does the sending part have? Voltage-gated channels, right? And different kinds of channels give those different parts of a neuron different kinds of properties. The voltage-gated allows action potentials to travel without decrement. All right, well, now let's talk about how cells communicate with each other. And cells communicate with each other through a junction called the synapse. So a synapse, so we're going to be talking about some anatomy and physiology too. Right? So there's going to be a nice structural functional relationship that you can appreciate in this. A synapse is the anatomical, which means, what does anatomy mean? Structure, right? So we're going to look at the anatomical and physiological. And what's physiology? So functional unit of communication between what? Between cells. So if you know how a synapse is put together, then you pretty much know how all cells communicate with each other. And it's very important for various cells to communicate with each other. A nerve will control a skeletal muscle. So a nerve is going to control or communicate with a muscle fiber. But other nerves communicate, or nerves will communicate with other nerve cells. They have to communicate with each other. Okay, and how are they going to communicate with each other? Via a synapse over here. So synapses can take one of two different forms. The first form can be a chemical synapse, and the second one can be an electrical. Okay, so what has to happen if something is electrical? If there is an electrical something in your body, electrical is what? When a charge is in motion, we call that a current, like a sodium current, for instance. That can be considered an electrical signal. Okay. A chemical, on the other hand, is going to use a signaling molecule and not a current of some kind. So these are the two kinds of synapses in your body. So what do we have on the slide right here? Okay, so it's a functional connection, but it's a structural connection as well between a neuron and another cell. And that could be a muscle or that could be another neuron. So where the signal is coming from is called the presynaptic cell. And where the signal is going to, we call that the postsynaptic cell. And what's in between them? The synapse, right? So there's a pre and post synaptic cell. All right, so there are two kinds, chemical versus electrical synapses. Most in your body are chemical. There's a few, or very few, that are electrical in nature. You're going to find out where these are in some cases. I'll maybe talk about one today. All right, so the way that information, right, because that's how you communicate information, not just noise from one cell to another, but information from one cell to another, we call that synaptic transmission. Okay, so synaptic transmission at a chemical synapse requires a chemical. That chemical is what we call a neurotransmitter. So the presynaptic cell is going to release a neurotransmitter, and some of you might actually know a name of a particular neurotransmitter. There are probably maybe 10 or 15 that we're going to learn in this class, but maybe right now you already know the name of one. Does anybody know the name of one neurotransmitter? Acetylcholine, I heard. That's good. That's a perfect example of a neurotransmitter that is secreted from a presynaptic cell and it goes to the postsynaptic cell. Okay. Electrical synapses are very rare in the nervous system. But we're going to talk about these first because they're the simplest to appreciate. All right, so most cells in your body, oh, I got to erase this other part of the diagram too. So most cells in your body do not touch each other. They're separated by interstitial space, fluid. All right, so here's a cell, here's a neighboring cell. So if there is electrical activity in this cell, it can't just jump over to this one over here. It can't get through this space. Okay, maybe it could under certain circumstances. Like, have you ever walked on a carpet or something and you're kind of shuffling your feet and then you reach out and touch somebody, what happens? You could get electrical shock. So what happened? There's like a little lightning bolt that hopped from you to yourself. Well, cells could communicate electrically very efficiently if there were lightning bolts between them. But are there lightning bolts inside your body? No, there are no lightning bolts in there. Okay, so in very few cells, how can these electrical currents get from one cell to another? There's got to be some kind of membrane protein that allows for the diffusion of these electrolytes to go from one cell directly into another. And these little connections between cells are what we call gap junctions. And then if there was another cell over here, as long as there's a gap junction, right? If this cell gets stimulated, that will stimulate this one, will stimulate this one, because the current can flow to all of these different cells. That does not happen in many places in your body. So consider an organ. You think of, and let's consider your biceps brachii. That's a nice muscle organ. All right, and you got some other organs, other muscles, biceps on the other side of your body. Would it be a good idea if all the muscles in your body were connected by gap junctions? So that if you stimulated one to contract, it would cause all of the muscle fibers in the biceps to contract, but also the brachialis and the flexor and extensor digitorums, right, and then the trapezius and rectus abdominis and then rectus femoris, all the muscles in your body. Would that be useful? Would it be useful if you contracted one muscle, if there was gap junctions everywhere, what would happen to your body? You'd go... Every time you tried to use a muscle, your whole body would contract, okay? It would be uncontrolled contraction, not very useful, and you'd be black and blue all over, right? So that's not good. What kind of organ might it be good to have electrical synapses? Think of an organ that, and you could think of a muscle that it all contracts together. You don't want the top part contracting from the bottom part or the right from the left. Okay? And somebody said, and that's a perfect example, your heart has gap junctions in it because you want your heart to contract as a functional unit to pump blood. So the heart doesn't have chemical synapses, it has electrical synapses. Skeletal muscle has, guess what kind? Chemical synapses. And if you look at the structure underneath a microscope of a cardiac muscle, you see cardiac muscles are very short, but where they connect up with each other, what do we call that, that junction between cardiac muscle cells? That is, what's that called? Somebody should probably remember. That's called an intercalated disc. And one of the components of an intercalated disc is a gap junction so that if one part of the heart contracts, that causes the whole heart to contract. Right, but not just in one layer, because what else can you tell me about cardiac muscle cells? Are they nice and linear like a skeletal muscle? They are also what? They have branches on them. So they branch up to the next higher layer, or they branch down to the next lower level. So if there's one stimulated, the whole heart in its length and depth gets stimulated and contracts because of the branching pattern of cardiac muscle fibers. So here we see a nice gap junction. We don't find these very much in brain, but we find it in cardiac, smooth muscle, some kinds of smooth muscle cells, right? Some brain cells. But most, by far, the most common is a chemical synapse. All right, so don't forget, what is a synapse again? It is the structural and functional unit of communication between cells. Okay. So how, in most cases, can one cell communicate with another if it's not an electrical synapse? All right, so here we see two cells. Here's the presynaptic, and here is the postsynaptic. So signals can only go from the presynaptic cell through the synapse to the postsynaptic cell and can't go backwards, and you'll see why that is in just a second. The presynaptic cell, all right, is going to be a neuron. And so this is the end of an axon. So here's an axon terminus. And you see that it has a little bulge to it right here. So it kind of looks like a button. So sometimes we call that a terminal button. Sometimes we call it a terminal bouton, which is, I think, French. Okay. Even us anglicized people say bouton sometimes. Or sometimes we call it a bouton terminale. That doesn't sound French at all, it sounds Italian. But anyway, bouton terminale, terminal button, axon terminus, all pretty much the same thing. And it's enlarged because it has a lot of mitochondria, because this area of the axon needs what? A lot of energy, ATP. All right? And it also has a bunch of vesicles in it. Right? These vesicles are storing the neurotransmitter. All right, so when there is an action potential flowing down the axon and gets to the axon terminus, what happens to the membrane voltage? It's not at RMP. What happens to it? It does what? The first thing, it depolarizes. So here, in this area right here, there are some voltage-gated calcium channels. When these reach threshold, the calcium channels open, and can you remember where calcium is high? Inside or outside the cell? It's outside the cell. So when these calcium channels open up because of this voltage that's sweeping over them, calcium enters the cell, right? And this is going to act as a signal for changing metabolism inside this bouton terminale. The calcium is going to bind to a molecule we call calmodulin, right? That just stands for cal for calcium. Modulin means it's going to modulate something inside the cell. And what calmodulin does is that it binds to a protein kinase. Now, what does a kinase do once again? A kinase? It adds a phosphate to something, right? So calmodulin, when it binds to protein kinase, can turn it from an inactive form to an active form. And so this protein kinase is going to phosphorylate a number of regulatory proteins inside the cell, right, that are going to cause fusing of the vesicle to predetermined areas on the, this is now the presynaptic membrane, right? And when that vesicle fuses, it's going to secrete neurotransmitter into the space between these two neurons. We call that the synaptic cleft. All right, so what is this process called where we have molecules that are going to be released outside the cell? What's that process called again? That's exocytosis. And is exocytosis active or passive? It is active transport, right? So it's going to require ATP. It's using microtubules to move these vesicles around inside the cell. And now we have a high region of neurotransmitter by the presynaptic cell, a low area of concentration at the postsynaptic cell. So are these neurotransmitters going to move? They're going to move from high concentration to low by what kind of process? By diffusion. So they're going to diffuse to the postsynaptic cell right here. Okay, so let's just go over this first part of synaptic transmission of a chemical synapse. The action potential comes down. That change in voltage on the membrane opens up voltage-gated calcium channels. Calcium enters a cell, binds to calmodulin, activates a protein kinase, right, which then causes the movement of these synaptic vesicles that contain neurotransmitter to the membrane, the presynaptic membrane. They're going to dock on the presynaptic membrane, and when they dock and fuse, it's going to exocytose neurotransmitter into the synaptic cleft. And then they're going to diffuse to the postsynaptic membrane right here. So that's pretty much everything so far. I don't think I missed anything. All right, so don't forget about exocytosis. And the amount of neurotransmitter that's released depends on, could it depend on the amplitude of an action potential coming down an axon? No, because what can you tell me about the amplitude of action potentials? Yeah, they're not graded. They're all the same. So that's not going to affect how much neurotransmitter is released. What's going to affect how much neurotransmitter can be released? The frequency of action potential. So if it's just one little blip, this neuron will release a little bit of neurotransmitter. But if this axon terminus is experiencing a blip, 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 it's going to release what? A lot of neurotransmitter into the synaptic cleft. So a lot of transmitter will diffuse to the postsynaptic membrane. Okay, I think I talked about this already. Okay. Oh, I need something. Where is it at? Well, how do we cause then what happens when these neurotransmitters reach the postsynaptic membrane? And I don't have a slide handy. There are receptors in the postsynaptic membrane, like what I drew right here. So let's just say this postsynaptic membrane is what, the sending part of a neuron or the receiving part? The postsynaptic membrane right here. It's going to be on, oh, I erased that beautiful picture. Okay, it's going to be on what? Dendrites and cell body. It's going to have ligand-gated channels, and when a neurotransmitter binds to a ligand-gated channel, it can cause that channel to open up and sodium enter the cell, and when that happens, what's that? That's what we call depolarization or a stimulus on that dendrite or the postsynaptic cell. And then what happens to that wave, that depolarization? It's going to flow over the dendrite, flow over the cell body, and if it's at threshold when it reaches the axon hillock, then that's going to start an action potential in the axon of that cell. So this is what we call a chemical synapse. So what ion in your body is real important for synaptic transmission? What ion signals the fusion of a vesicle to the presynaptic membrane? And somebody said it already before I even could say the question. It is calcium. Okay, so how do neurons, what important ion is important for synaptic transmission in all your brain and nervous system? It is calcium. Calcium is signaling the release of neurotransmitter. So where do you think it's more important to have calcium? In the extracellular space outside axon terminals right here? Or more important to have calcium in bones to make bones strong? Okay? Because you think it's important to have strong bones? Probably, because otherwise they're going to break and then you're going to have a bunch of broken bones. That's no fun. But what is probably more important? For neurons to communicate with each other or for you to have strong bones? Because what can you do without a nervous system? You're absolutely useless without a nervous system, right? So when your body is low on calcium, as what happens as we get older, guess what your body does? It sacrifices bones to get calcium so that your nervous system can function. Okay? So it is important for bones to have strong, good calcium levels, but it's even more important for at least this one reason. We're going to come up with other reasons during this class. It's important to have good extracellular levels of calcium just for synaptic transmission so that you can have a nervous system that can communicate inside of itself. Okay. And that's one of the reasons why we lose bone mass as we get older. Okay. All right, so I talked about all these kinds of things. Okay, let's talk about some other important things about synaptic transmission at a chemical synapse. All right, so the ligand diffuses across the cleft, the synaptic cleft, binds to receptor protein on the postsynaptic membrane. Oh, I guess I'll go back for just a second. Now, on this slide, I don't see any receptor proteins, but I said they are on what membrane, the presynaptic membrane or the post? As a matter of fact, you're right. It's the postsynaptic membrane. And only the postsynaptic membrane. There are no receptors, at least as far as we know. There might be sometime we learn in your life, but at least right now, you should know that there are no receptor proteins in the presynaptic membrane. Right? Also, the postsynaptic cell does not have any synaptic vesicles that contain neurotransmitter. So those are the two reasons why information cannot go retrograde from the postsynaptic cell to the presynaptic cell. Because in order for that to happen, the postsynaptic cell would have to have neurotransmitter to be released, and the presynaptic cell would have to have receptors for that neurotransmitter. So signals cannot be propagated or cannot be transmitted retrograde through a synapse. You might have to write that down, ask me next time if that's not making sense. Okay. Okay, so that ligand, or this neurotransmitter, diffuses across the cleft because of diffusion, well, because of a high concentration gradient, binds to the receptor protein, and that opens the chemically regulated ion channel. And there can be a couple different forms of communication. There can be an excitatory communication or an inhibitory form of that communication. Right. If when a ligand binds to a channel, a sodium channel, that's going to cause depolarization. Right? And depolarization is going to be excitatory because if you look at that action potential, what's really the first part of an action potential? It is what? The stimulus. Right? That stimulus is due to an inflow of sodium into a cell causing it to depolarize. We call that an EPSP. Or an excitatory postsynaptic potential. Where does that postsynaptic potential refer to? Right, this membrane right here. If it is an excitatory postsynaptic potential, that means that when a ligand binds to a receptor protein in this membrane right here, it opens up specifically a sodium channel. So what happens then? When a sodium channel opens up, what happens? Which way does sodium go? Inside the cell. It goes from high concentration to low. And when sodium enters the cell, what happens to the resting membrane potential of this cell? It depolarizes, right? It goes to zero. That's what a stimulus is. It's an excitatory stimulus. Okay. And so we would call that an excitatory postsynaptic potential. But now let's say that we don't have a ligand-gated channel that is a sodium channel, but let's say that it's a potassium channel. So the neurotransmitter is released, it binds to a receptor protein that opens up a specific channel for potassium. Which way is potassium going to go? It's going to go out. It's going to go from the postsynaptic cell into the synapse. And when that happens, does that depolarize or hyperpolarize the membrane? It hyperpolarizes the membrane. So does that take it to threshold or farther away from threshold? When potassium leaves, it takes RMP farther away from threshold, so that's going to inhibit this neuron from firing an action potential. And that's what we call an inhibitory postsynaptic potential, or an IPSP. So hyperpolarizing channel, Our IPSPs, they're due to, for instance, potassium channels that are opening. EPSPs are due to sodium channels that are opening. So that would be good to modify your notes with. Okay. Now, where do we find EPSPs and IPSPs on a neuron? Is it going to be the receiving part or the sending part? Is it only the receiving part, dendrites and cell bodies, because that's where ligand-gated channels are, on dendrites and cell bodies, right? So there can be two different kinds of receptors. Okay. So here we have a picture of a neuron, just a nice multipolar neuron. We have the soma and cell body, so these are all synapses right here. Here is an end of the presynaptic cell. This is an axon right here, and it's synapsing on a soma, so we would call this a axosomatic synapse. I don't know if you'd learn this in anatomy or not. Okay. Some axons terminate on a dendrite. We would call that an axodendritic synapse versus axosomatic. All right, so what kind of channels do we have over here on dendrites and cell bodies? We have the ligand-gated. And in this axon over here, we've got the voltage-gated. Okay, so here we have two different neurons synapsing on a cell body. And if one is producing EPSPs and the other is producing IPSPs, what's going to be the effect by the time these graded potentials reach the axon hillock? If one is excitatory and the other is inhibitory, when they add together, what's going to happen? They're going to cancel out. And if they cancel out, what happens to the action potential on this axon right here? It's not going to happen, right? So this neuron can integrate information from various neurons to make a decision on what to do. So EPSPs and IPSPs can summate, right, at this axon hillock, the trigger zone, to determine whether an action potential is going to fire or not. Okay. So I think next time, this is the really cool part. I'm going to start here on this slide. Well, maybe I'll go back and talk a little bit about this one, but I talked about this slide already. Go ahead and review this one over the weekend, but we're going to start right here with acetylcholine. And so what is acetylcholine? It's a neurotransmitter, right? What cell secretes acetylcholine, the presynaptic cell or postsynaptic cell? The presynaptic cell, right. Okay.